Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Later on in the hour, we'll talk to Daniel Lurie about why he thinks he should be San Francisco's next mayor. And we'll meet the founder of Empowerment Avenue, a nonprofit that supports the art of incarcerated people. But first, I'm delighted to be joined by our regular contributor and friend of the show, Dr. Peter Chin Hong. He's an infectious disease doctor from UCSF. Welcome, Peter.
Always a pleasure, Grace. Well, a reunion.
It's a reunion. But when you're on, I know that something's bubbling up on the health front. So last week, the San Francisco Department of Health issued an advisory recommending indoor masking for the general public in every indoor setting in response to the latest COVID surge. I personally haven't seen many people following that advice, but tell us what prompted the recommendation.
I think, you know, first of all, California was unusually the first place in the U.S. to have increasing cases over the summer. And we thought, okay, we're seeing it a month earlier. It's starting in the West Coast and in the Bay Area, actually. And maybe it's going to end really quickly as the rest of the country picked up. But so far, there's no end in sight. We haven't hit a plateau yet. So my feeling is that the DPH said, hey, you know, this is not going down anytime soon. Let's put an exclamation point on what's happening, and hopefully a few transmissions could be averted.
Are other health departments in California cities making this recommendation, or is San Francisco an outlier?
I think San Francisco is the only one that I know of so far, but as a jurisdiction, and it's not a mandate, it's just having people have heightened awareness in the medical setting or in congregate settings like nursing homes or other areas like where people gather. Individuals can make decisions based on their own metrics and risks and benefits. So that also is happening kind of unofficially under the scenes as well.
You know, during the summer, a lot of people are stuck inside because they need the air conditioning. It's so hot in other places around the country. It's interesting to me that it's here in San Francisco that we're seeing such a spike. Do researchers have any sense of why that's happening or why that happened here first?
I mean, there's several generic reasons, and I'll come to why the Bay Area perhaps. So the reasons why include a new variant family that's about 20% more transmissible. People are still traveling a lot. Revenge travel is still a thing. You add 6 months, 4 to 6 months since the last time a lot of people got infected, and this is about now. And, you know, I think the other factor that's a little bit different this year is we happen to also have a lot of heat waves in the area, not just San Francisco, but in the surrounding counties. And that probably contributes. Then we have the fires. So I think compounding all of that, you see weather-related congregation of people. Interestingly, the Southeast is also a big hotspot for COVID. And that is what people normally expect because of the oppressive heat during the summer.
Well, there is this new flirt variant that people have been talking about, and I think that's what you're referring to. Tell us, is it more infectious? Does it have different symptoms?
It's more infectious, probably by about 20%. It is a little bit more immune evasive, but our vaccines still work well against serious disease, hospitalization, and death. And, you know, it doesn't cause more serious disease as we know it. But, you know, what it also does, which is similar to the other COVID variants, is that it does exploit weaknesses in our community, and that is our vulnerable populations.
So do you mean children and the elderly, or
mainly the elderly? COVID is mainly about the elderly. So those, not just over 65, but those over 75, those who are very immune compromised, and particularly those who haven't gotten the shot since it came out in the fall of 2023. So that those are really the risk factors for people I see in my practice in the hospital still. Even though a lot of people seem to be doing okay in the community, there's still a group of people who are very ill.
So, Peter, should I be getting a booster right now? I mean, I'm somebody who, knock on wood, hasn't had COVID this summer. I said that, now I'm going to get it tomorrow. But I mean, should I be getting a booster?
No, I think, Grace, you probably don't need to get a booster. You can wait till the same time you get one in October with the flu shot. You don't want to get it too early. You want it to
get in time so your antibodies peak. But for those who are older than 65 and those who are very immune compromised, particularly if you never had this one that was released in the fall of 2023, I would say go ahead and get it. You can still have your cake and eat it too, because that you would still be allowed to get the new vaccine when it comes out in time. And again, like, what's prompting SF to do this? And it's just that we've not seen a plateau yet in the number of cases.
Well, you know, we're 4 years into COVID, and people, I mean, everybody around me is an amateur epidemiologist, I feel like. That's one learning from COVID. But there's also a more of an understanding, and I think actually fear of long COVID. We're hearing about people's symptoms and brain fog. And, you know, is the flirt variant more likely to lead to long COVID, or is the jury still out on that?
So we had a really, that's a great question, because just in the last week, we had a big study published in the New England Journal of Medicine showing that over time, the probability of getting long COVID symptoms is growing shorter, particularly amongst vaccinated people, and that by getting a vaccine, you drop the risk by as much as 70%. But even when you look at unvaccinated people, going from Alpha to Delta to Omicron flavors, including flirt, the risk is a little bit lower, but there is still a risk nonetheless, but you can lower the risk by getting vaccines.
Is long COVID, are we understanding long COVID to have sort of idiosyncratic responses, depends on who you are, what long COVID is? Because people I know who have it, they list symptoms, and it feels like it's a little bit different for each person.
Yes, because I think we are probably treating a lot of different diseases as one umbrella, having it under one umbrella term, whereas long COVID is probably three or four different diseases, probably each requiring a different type of therapy. But for now, we are really in the infancy in learning about long COVID and really how to make people feel better. What we've learned most recently is that bits of virus can persist in people's gut and in their stream for as long as 15 or 16 months. We also know that, unfortunately, taking Paxlovid doesn't, in a randomized controlled trial, doesn't seem to lower the risk or accelerate people's recovery after getting long COVID.
Well, I was going to ask you about Paxlovid. I mean, with flirt, should I be trying to get Paxlovid as soon as I test positive?
I think the way we think about Paxlovid now, as most of the population is getting more and more immune, is that for sure the shoulds are people over 65, particularly if they've not been vaccinated in the last year, and those who are very immune compromised. Drug interactions, of course, is something you need to be careful about. And then everybody else could get it. If you have a serious case, we're allowed to prescribe it for those over the age of 12. But more and more studies in the current era show that people who are under 50 probably don't benefit as much, because they are probably less likely to go into the hospital anyway. But if a patient comes to me and asks me for it and they have a very serious symptoms, I'm not going to stop them from getting it, if they have favorable drug interactions, et cetera.
You know, there's a lot of fatigue that comes around COVID advice. I mean, I don't think anybody willingly wants to wear a mask, and people don't really want to heed that staying away from people and all the things that we would do 3 years ago without even being asked. So as a practitioner and somebody who tries to give best advice to his patients, how do you deal with that fatigue where people say, ugh, I'm so over this, I don't want to do that?
Well, I think different strokes would many options, because it's not one size fits all. It's not like we're putting all our eggs in the mask basket, like, you know, when people talk about masks, or everything is amazing about vaccines only. It's kind of like what fits in best for you and what's your risk of doing poorly. And even if you're not interested in a vaccine and you get ill, maybe you'll be okay with getting an antiviral. Maybe you don't want an antiviral, but maybe you're okay with wearing a mask for a short period of time because it could be disruptive to you, or maybe because you live with elderly relatives at home. So I think there are different reasons that different people take, and it's not one size fits all. And that's what I've learned over time.
Well, as always, good advice from Dr. Peter Chin Hong. He is an infectious disease specialist at UCSF. Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Grace.
And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk to mayoral candidate Daniel Lurie. That's right after the break. Stay with us.
This week on The Arts, our weekly radio magazine of the performing arts, you'll get a preview of the Cambrillo Festival of Contemporary Music. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. I'll be in conversation with artistic director and conductor Christian Macellaru, and we'll feature music of Clarissa Assad, Nina Young, and Lambert Beecher, among others. It's the Cambrillo Festival on The Arts, Wednesday afternoon at 4. Join us.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. We'll explore what it's like to be phenomenally autistic with artist, author, and illustrator Ayanna Davis.
I didn't speak much, even when spoken to. My way to communicate was always through art.
Autistic Joy. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. The race for San Francisco mayor is a crowded one. Here on State of the Bay, we've spoken to the leading candidates and you've asked your questions. We've heard from London Breed, Mark Farrell, Aaron Peskin, and Asha Safai. And tonight, well, and if you've missed any of those, go to the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And tonight, for our final interview, we're really pleased to be joined by Daniel Lurie, yet another candidate for mayor. Daniel, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're so delighted you could be here. And before we jump into our conversation, I wanted to invite the listeners to add their questions or comments. What would you like to ask Daniel Lurie, and what are the main issues you'll be voting on when you go to the polls in November? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us an email, stateofthebay@kalw.org. Well, Daniel, I mean, it's so great to have you here. And I just wanted to jump into it because the news moves fast and there's a lot of news that's been coming out. Last week, London Breed announced that the city would be instituting, quote, aggressive sweeps of homeless encampments. Do you agree with that approach?
Here's what I think. This injunction that was put in place 2 years ago has been used as an excuse by this administration, this mayor, not to do their job. We should have built enough shelter beds to get around that injunction. And now with grants passed, we still need to build more shelter. And my plan in the first 6 months of my administration will be to stand up 1,500 emergency shelter beds. We're going to offer people safe, dignified shelter. We're going to double down on Homeward Bound. We're going to build out more mental health and drug treatment beds. Otherwise, we're just going to keep pushing people from one block to another, like this administration has done for far too long. The excuses must end. The mayor said, the governor said the excuses had to end. Karen Bass, the mayor of LA, has tackled this issue quite well. And it starts with more shelter beds.
Well, I mean, Gavin Newsom had a similar directive. And as you point out, Karen Bass in Los Angeles has said, we're not going to enforce that directive from the governor. And San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan has come out against Newsom's directive as well. So I'm going to ask you just very specifically, do you oppose the directive of Gavin Newsom and London Breed's decision to have aggressive sweeps?
Well, I just said what I would do. Whether or not there's a directive, the Mayor Bass is right. The directive is one thing. We can no longer have people sleep on our streets because there's nothing progressive about it. I've been saying this for close to a year since I launched my campaign. We need to get tough on drug dealers. We need to make sure that people don't come to San Francisco to deal drugs, to use drugs, or to sleep on our streets. Why I'm confident that my approach will work is because I've actually built shelter. I built 78 units of shelter at 33 Gough Street. It's safe. It's dignified. You move people from the street into, in this case, tiny homes, and it works. And then you can get people stabilized and on a path to recovery. Sweeping people from one block to the next does not work. So the directive is one thing. But then you need to implement it. And what we've seen from this mayor is a lot of talk and not a lot of follow through.
So what I'm hearing is that you wouldn't authorize sweeps.
Wendy, what I've said I will do is stand up shelter beds, move people from the streets into shelter. You have to offer people a shelter bed. You have to bag and tag. That's the order where you have to make sure you take care of their belongings. And you make sure it's safe and it's dignified. And now with Grants Pass, you have the toolkit of citing somebody if they don't move. But staying on our streets is no longer an option.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, your nonprofit, Tipping Point Community, has put so much energy into anti-poverty efforts. And, you know, homelessness and housing are, you know, sort of a big focus of that organization. And, you know, that organization has done so much to create. So one of these organizations that you funded is trying to create deeply affordable housing to end homelessness. You hear a lot from homeless advocates saying that, you know, shelter beds are good, but a lot of people don't want to be in shelters because they can't bring their things, they can't bring their pets, there are too many rules. So right. when you talk about building shelter beds, do you also want to try to build affordable housing as well?
So I've also built affordable housing, but just to be clear about Tipping Point's mission, an organization I started in 2005 and has raised over $500 million to tackle issues of poverty ranging from education, which is actually what we funded the most, early childhood education, also housing and employment. So we funded four issue areas. One of those was housing and homelessness. And I told you that we built shelter, but we also did build affordable housing. We got a project done at 833 Bryant. We got it done on time, under budget, with good paying union labor. It took us from the time we bought the parking lot to the time somebody opened the door, it was 3 years and $377,000 a unit. And this administration has failed to take our model and really double down on it. We should be building more affordable housing for our teachers, for our nurses, for our firefighters, for our first responders, and for the people that make this city go. We need to build more affordable housing. I'm confident that we can do it because I've done it.
Well, you know, from that experience of building those units in 3 years, which probably in other places of the country, that feels like a really long time. But in San Francisco, that feels like a little bit of a miracle. Yeah. What is replicable about that model on a citywide level?
Well, we finally saw a second version of it just last week announced. Apple and John Sobrato, along with the Housing Accelerator Fund, we're going to use the money actually from 833 Bryant and a few other sources to build 135 units of senior housing. What's replicable is making sure that we bring people together to cut down on the time and the cost it takes. So that project at Valencia Street and Mission should take, still should just take 3 years. It'll be $577,000 a unit. Partnering with people like Rebecca Foster and the Housing Accelerator Fund, getting creative on our financing, unlocking. We do have 70,000 units that have been approved. Yes, the high interest rates are causing problems. Mm-hmm. Hopefully those start coming down and we can start building more housing. But we need to get the unions on board. We need to get them to the table. It's what we did at Tipping Point, and I'll do that as mayor.
What makes building a unit of housing like that so expensive? Again, these are numbers in San Francisco that we all sort of say, oh, $577,000. Okay. But in other parts of the country, they're just kind of scratching their heads wondering, my gosh, why does it cost so much to build a single unit of housing in San Francisco? Is there any way to bring those costs down?
Yeah, Grace, the City Hall insiders I'm running against, you've interviewed the other four. Mm-hmm. They've built up this broken, ineffective, and frankly corrupt City Hall bureaucracy. It took on average 1,100 days to get through the permitting process here in San Francisco. That's where the breakdown is. They've created so much bureaucracy, so much red tape that it has caused the state to come in and take over our planning commission in the sense that SB 423 has now come in. And, you know, you had the mayor and Senator Weir kind of celebrating the state coming in. But it's years of failure in the making. Now, I think it will help us get housing built more quickly, which I am for. But we still have to then, once you get through planning, you still have to go through the Department of Building and Inspections. And on average, Grace, it takes 600 days to get through that. This is why John Ram, the former planning commissioner, has endorsed me, because he knows that my plan will get and expedite housing, and that what has been built up over the last 15 years in this city is broken, dysfunctional, and corrupt.
Well, I think anybody who's ever tried to do a renovation in San Francisco just kind of winced at that number with familiarity. I wanted to move on to public safety, which is another cornerstone of your campaign. Recently the police announced a new policy to restrict pretextual stops, and that would be traffic stops for low-level violations. The new rule just specifically prohibits officers from pulling over drivers for having like one non-working taillight or an item hanging from a rearview mirror or a missing license plate, among other violations. Do you support that?
Well, you said the police came out with that, or the police commission?
The police commission, yes. But do you support that?
Here's how I would approach this. We need a fully staffed police department. We need our officers walking the beat, out on patrol, deterring and preventing crime. Some of those low-level things, I think DPT, Department of Parking and Traffic, could be doing. I think we need more red light cameras, more speed cameras, catching offenders, and making sure that our police are able to do the work of policing. And in our city, that means we need more officers walking merchant corridors, out on patrol, out in the Richmond district right now. On a good day, according to the captain out there, there's 3 patrol cars patrolling for 100,000 people. Hmm. People are flying through stop signs. They're flying through red lights. We all know this. I talk to families all the time. They're scared to walk their kids, whether it's in the Excelsior or in Cal Hollow or in the Mission. Traffic violations are not going, they're not being enforced. And so are there other ways to do this? DPD, red light cameras, safety cameras. I'm for using technology to crack down on these moving violations.
Do you think that this police commission policy that's been suggested will be helpful to reduce some like biased stops?
I think we will wait and see. What I want to see from the police commission is them finding ways to work with our police force. We always need police oversight. Always. And we have a police oversight body. And I would like to see the commission and the police finding ways to cooperate and collaborate. This is the problem in our city, is that every issue is a political bloodbath. It's always warring. It's always demonizing each other. We need to find ways to work together. And frankly, we need to allow police officers to do their jobs. That means, in my mind, I'm glad to see all the reforms that have put in place. I've done 6 ride-alongs with police officers from Bayview to the Mission to Central to the Tenderloin. All of them, all the officers, to a person, told me they like wearing the body-worn cameras. Hmm. They like the policy of not chasing in crowded parts of town, which I agree wholeheartedly with. So I think this police force has been reformed very well. We always need police oversight, but we also need to make sure our police can do their jobs.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've been talking about how short-staffed the department is and actually overtaxed because it is short-staffed. Mm-hmm. I mean, this has led to a lot of overtime for the officers who are on the beat, and some officers are paid as much as $500,000 a year. I'm sure you come to the issues of like the city budget with a sort of a mind's eye to being efficient. When you see figures like that, what do you think?
I think it's not sustainable and it's not okay. I think we need we're short 500 police officers. And this mayor has been at times for public safety and other times against it. The former interim mayor was also not always for public safety, was an obstructionist on officer pay. And it has led to the decline of over 500 officers from our stated mandatory minimum level of 2,000 police officers. We're below 1,500 right now. We do not want officers working this much overtime. I'd like to see more officers, less overtime. But really, I also want to see more officers from the community. I want to see officers that look like the communities that they serve. I want to see officers speak the language of the communities that they serve. I want our officers living in San Francisco because you police better. And that's where we have to get more housing built. Only 20% of our teachers, our firefighters, and our police officers live in San Francisco. And when you have police officers that don't live in the city, policing is not as effective. And so whatever we can do to recruit officers from SF State, from City College, from USF, make it a profession that is looked upon as one that is noble again, and one that takes care of our community, I think is really, really important and has gotten lost in the, do we need more police? Do we need less police? We need police that know their neighborhoods, know the merchants, and people who are in community feel safe talking to them.
Hmm. Well, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm Grace Wan. We're talking to Daniel Lurie. He's running for mayor, and he's here to answer your questions. You can join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can send us an email at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Well, one of your opponents, Mark Farrell, has suggested on Twitter, and we talked to him about this, and he'd like to see the National Guard brought into the Tenderloin. And also he'd like to see, he probably wouldn't retain the current police chief, Bill Scott, if he was to become mayor. What's your position on those two issues?
I've talked about calling for a fentanyl state of emergency on day one of my administration. I want to surge resources. I want to get tough on first-time drug dealers. Law enforcement experts say that my plan puts those drug dealers out of business. And then I want to surge resources on the demand side. There's a lot of tough talk on drug users, and we're going to, drug test all of them. But there should be a sense that we hold the system accountable. And the people I'm running against have built up a system where they had bigger budgets every year. They've had worse outcomes, and they have created a system where if someone, Grace, wants help, if they're in the throes of addiction and they're like, okay, I want to go to a place like HealthRight 360, they're turned away 50% of the time. And yet we're spending $700 million a year on our behavioral health system, and it's broken. And we need to build more mental health and drug treatment beds. When someone is put on a 5150 hold, which means they're put, against their will and brought to one of our eight emergency rooms, Grace, 64% of the time last year, 13,000 people were brought to on a 5150 hold mm-hmm. in a 12-month period. 64% of the time, those people were released back to the street with no game plan. I'm going to have care coordinators on site at those emergency rooms doing warm handoffs to those beds. Mm-hmm. That's how we go at the open air drug markets. We coordinate with our local, state, and federal law enforcement. And that would be my plan in terms of, who I'm going to fire. I'm running against a couple people that, are seemingly applying to be on next season's Apprentice and telling people who they're going to fire. I think that's bad leadership. And actually talking about letting someone in the police chief go has created actually more moral crisis at our police department. Mm. And it's not how I lead. What I have said to everybody, and I'll say to you tonight, is on November 6th, at the day after we win this election, I'm going to sit down with every one of my major department heads, and we're going to have a tough talk. And we're going to say, do you want to be held accountable? Do you want to be in this job? And there's going to be a lot of people that are going to leave, but I'm not going to sit here as a candidate and tell you I'm firing this department head and that department head. I think that's a bombastic way to lead, and it's not how I lead.
Hmm. Well, you have said that we need to make San Francisco more attractive for business, and certainly San Francisco revenues rely a great deal on corporate taxes and property taxes, both commercial and residential. What can you do to entice business to come back to San Francisco? Mm-hmm. Understanding that a lot of these issues are regional or statewide, it's not particularly San Francisco.
Well, actually, I would disagree on that. You know, when you're the worst run city in America, when you have a crisis of confidence in terms of your safety, downtown, clean streets, I think we have a crisis of leadership in our city. And I think business leaders, both small business and big business, tell me that they don't want to be here. I've talked to many successful small business entrepreneurs who have opened up restaurants, opened up stores. They're 5 or 6 stores in, and they're like, I'm done with this city because they make it so painful to do business here. They fee me to death. And then they don't protect me. There is a restaurant owner in the Tenderloin who I've talked to many times. I won't name her here, but she said to me, Daniel, if I fail, I want it to be because my food is not good, not because I can't protect my customers inside the restaurant. Hmm. She's had restaurants, her customers be assaulted. That is not okay. And that is where we need to make sure our streets are safe and clean downtown. That's why I talk about the fact that we were able to do it for APEC. We were able to do it for the JP Morgan conference. We should be able to keep people safe. We should be able to keep our streets clean 365 days a year for our taxpayers and for our residents. And we need downtown to feel that way. We need people feeling like they can come in from the East Bay, from the South Bay, from Marin, and have dinner in San Francisco again. Come shop in Union Square without feeling scared to park their car and whether it's going to be broken into or not. Mm. So I have a big vision that we're going to, you know, after, let's call it the first term, we're going to be recruiting world-class companies back here. CEOs are going to have to be headquartered here. But after the first 2 years of my administration, I want all of our friends who live in the Peninsula and South Bay and the East Bay and in Marin to say, hey, Grace, I want to come see you in San Francisco. I want to come have dinner and see a show with you. Right now, you know, all of our friends say they don't want to come up here. And whether or not that's overblown or not, our reputation is struggling. It's why I'm proud to have been part of working with Manny to start the Civic Joy Fund to create creative and nightlife and arts and culture. Last year, I was part of, you know, countering this narrative, and proud to have brought joy back to San Francisco. But we need the mayor to step up and do that mm-hmm. every single day. And I will do that starting January 8th.
Well, we're getting a slew of comments and questions for you. So I'll just read a few to you. Sarah writes, I just returned home from some time away from San Francisco. My house had been broken into and one of my local restaurants that had been in business for 18 years had closed. It's hard not to see a connection. What will you do as mayor to support the residential experience of San Francisco, specifically reducing crime and encouraging local businesses? And another email from John who says, what are you going to do to support small businesses, Mayor? And I think you've talked a little bit about that, but it is those corporations, but then it's the everyday person that we want.
Listen, Grace, it goes to, so part of the plan on the surging resources to the drug and mental health crisis is that not every interaction on the streets with somebody in the throes of addiction or in a mental health crisis needs to be with somebody with a badge and a gun. I want our police actually taking a step back, and I'm going to send out trained clinicians, and those trained clinicians will be able to bring people back to a 24/7 crisis center. But what that's going to do is allow our police officers to respond more quickly because they're going to be walking the beat. They're going to be out in patrol cars. They're going to be able to get to the site of a burglary much more quickly. Our 911 response times are at dangerously slow levels. For a priority A incident level call right now, highest level for our police, the average response time is 9.5 minutes. That's unacceptable in a major city like ours. That's where we talked about the overtime. 500 mm-hmm. officers short means that someone breaks into a home. These criminals, these offenders, they know they're going to get away with it because this response times are so low. So Sarah and John and all those people, I hear this every day. We need more officers out on the beat, walking the beat and out on patrol so that they can respond quickly and efficiently to these calls.
Well, I've read some interviews that you've given, and you speak with some admiration of Michael Bloomberg, who was the former mayor of New York City, in terms of his ability to kind of master the details and get things done. Is that a model of what you'd like to see in San Francisco?
Grace, I tell people I'm going to be looking at how Dianne Feinstein, Mayor Feinstein, did her job, which was walking the streets, understanding intimately what was going on. I think your mayor needs to be out and about and not just, at ribbon cutting ceremonies. I'm going to make sure my department heads know that I'm on top of it, that I'm holding them accountable. If they've told me they're going to get a project done, I'm pulling them out of their office and they're going to meet me on that street. corner, and they're going to tell me why something is either done or not done. And then I'm going to marry that with how Bloomberg organized his office. Mapping the mayor's office to the bureaucracy is going to be key. So, for example, I'm going to have a small business deputy. So for every department that touches a small business, we're going to have a deputy reporting directly to me so I know if things are getting done on behalf of our small businesses. And what, you know, I admired a lot about Mayor Bloomberg is that he understood how to run a business, and he obviously ran New York City very well. We have to hold people accountable. Mm-hmm. He did that in his business, and then he did that as mayor. I actually watched him in his first 2 years. I lived in New York City, and you could feel a palpable change in how that city was run, and you will feel that when I take office starting in January 8th.
The San Francisco Democratic Party just endorsed London Breed, and of the candidates, you're the one who doesn't have any city hall experience. You haven't held elected office before, and you know your ideas sound great, but you've run a nonprofit with several dozen employees, but the city has 35,000 workers, a $14 billion city and county budget. What makes you the right person for this incredibly difficult job?
I'll put my experience up against any one of these city hall insiders. And Grace, I love that I get a chance to talk about this. They have 70 years of combined experience, and they have rubber stamped bigger budgets every single year, worse outcomes. They've never held these nonprofits or these contractors accountable. My experience matches and meets this moment better than anybody else's. I was asked by Mayor Lee in 2013 to bring Super Bowl 50 to the Bay Area. I worked with mayors all across this region, including Sam Liccardo in San Jose and Mayor Schaaf in Oakland and Mayor Lee here. We brought the whole region together to pull off a very complicated event, and I was proud to lead that. We did such a good job that we got NBA All-Star game coming in 2025.
Cannot wait for that.
Super Bowl is coming back, Grace, in 2026, and six World Cup matches. And I have been a big part of that, or part of that. And so excited about that. And then back to that housing project we talked about. There was controversy around getting this building built, and the supervisors came under withering criticism. I went, worked with all 11. I got a unanimous vote at the Board of Supervisors. I've worked with every mayor since Mayor Newsom, all the way through Mayor Breed. I know that city. I know the department heads. I know the supervisors. I'm just not beholden to any of them. I'm not going to owe anybody anything when I walk into that office next January. No one has been scratching my back, and I won't need to scratch anyone else's back. I have the right experience for this moment.
So you're an outsider, but you have inside understandings of how it works. I mean, one thing that every candidate needs to think about in San Francisco is we have ranked choice voting. And I'm curious, what's your ranked choice voting strategy? What are you telling voters out there to do?
Listen, I'm still assessing, Grace, but here's what I'll tell you and all your listeners. Put Daniel Lurie number one. That's key. Let's see how this plays out. I've frankly been a little disappointed in some of my rivals and how they're running, how they've led the city, how they're running their campaigns. One thing I can tell you is that November 6th, we're going to have won this election, and I'm going to have, run a clean, ethical, moral campaign that puts our residents and our taxpayers first. And for me, this is not about how do I do something for myself. This is really about me trying to help turn around the city that I love. I want all of our kids, and I want my two kids, to be proud to say they're from San Francisco again and not have to apologize for it. And by the way, this city, we are not only coming back, but we're going to go to greater heights, but it needs accountable leadership and new ideas. And it's not going to come from the same City Hall insiders that got us into this mess.
Well, it's such a pleasure to have you here today with us on State of the Bay. Daniel Lurie, thank you so much for joining us.
Grace, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and listeners, we know you had a lot of comments and questions. We're going to shift those over to the campaign to see if they can get answered. Coming up after the break, The Art of the Incarcerated. We'll be right back.
On the next Your Calls One Planet series, we'll discuss President Biden's climate record. In 2022, he signed the Inflation Reduction Act, which has been hailed as the single largest investment in clean energy and climate action in U.S. history. Under Biden, the U.S. has also become the world's largest producer of oil and biggest exporter of natural gas. How would a Harris administration be different? Join the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
And that will be a rebroadcast this morning's Your Call, and that happens tonight at 7 o'clock here on 91.7 KALW, San Francisco, the Bay Area.
This week on The Arts, our weekly radio magazine of the performing arts, you'll get a preview of the Cambrillo Festival of Contemporary Music. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. I'll be in conversation with artistic director and conductor Christian Macellaru, and we'll feature music of Clarissa Assad, Nina Young, and Lambert Beecher, among others. It's the Cabrillo Festival on the Arts, Wednesday afternoon at 4. Join us.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan, and tonight we're joined by Oakland resident Rahsaan Thomas. He's the executive director of Empowerment Avenue and also an award-winning artist and co-host of the Pulitzer Prize-nominated podcast, Ear Hustle. He's also featured in the documentary What These Walls Won't Hold, which was awarded a top prize at the San Francisco International Film Festival. And Thomas accomplished all this while incarcerated at San Quentin. He was paroled in 2023 and now works to promote the artistic endeavors of people housed in prisons through his nonprofit, Empowerment Avenue. Welcome to State of the Bay, Rahsaan.
Thank you. Thank you, Babin.
So I wanted to start with what art means for you. I mean, you started this nonprofit to help other people who come from similar situations as you. But in your own life, what has art meant for you and done for you?
Art is healing. It's a way to make beauty out of chaos. It's also a path to proximity and change and growth and now economic empowerment.
I think that's so true that it takes chaos and makes beauty. How did you discover that you were an artist?
That's a great question. When I was a kid, I used to doodle on all my homework, all my notebooks. I would like make these superhero characters, just doodle away. And so my mom took me to art classes at Brooklyn College, even though I was like in junior high at the time. This was just trying to encourage that artistic side. But when I got there, there was guys that were so incredibly talented, I got intimidated. Like, never really followed through, never went back. But when I was incarcerated, like, writing was a necessity. There's like no way around writing because nobody's coming to save you. So you got to file your own appeal. You can't use the phone for months at a time. So you got to write letters. And I also envisioned that if I could become a writer, I can have a positive impact for prison and make my sons proud of me, even if I never went home.
Tell me about the inspiration behind Empowerment Avenue. Can you share where the idea came from?
Yeah, it started with just a need that needed to be filled because I felt like I was in a prison that, like, you know, a lot of labels, and we ran around with like little supervision. You had to be in your cell at certain times, like count time and night time. But other than that, you can go in and out. So anyway, even though all these lifers, all these people who committed crimes that were like either three strikes or actually really violent crimes, it still was one of the safest places I'd ever been. And so I felt like I had solutions to gun violence and, you know, drug addiction and all these solutions, but society wasn't listening to us because we caused harm and we weren't valued as experts in these fields. And so I had a lot to write about, and I felt like writing for the San Quentin was awesome, but like, I feel like I was preaching to the choir. I feel like the paper that just went to the same other incarcerated people, went to other prisons and just social justice advocates. It didn't get past the choir. So I longed for a way to get my voice in bigger spaces. And I also wanted to make enough money to at least take care of myself. I was like a 40-year-old man asking my mommy to send me a package, right? Like, needing deodorant, toothpaste, stuff the state didn't provide. And so I wanted to be able to take care of myself and hopefully help take care of my kids. And so it just was a necessity. And so I started trying to write for outside publications. And, I needed places that were male friendly, and there weren't that many. A typical requirement is to submit through something called Submittable. And I can't do Submittable for myself, or I can't even do email. And so I didn't have a way to use, there's no Microsoft Word, there's no editing software, there's no track changes. All that was beyond me. And so I needed some help. And I noticed a friend of mine was getting published left and right. And the difference between me and him, besides him being a slightly better writer, is he had help. He had an editor that was editing his pieces, pitching them for him, doing the email, doing the Submittable. And so he was getting published left and right. And so I was looking for that, not only for myself, but I felt like there were a lot of great writers in San Quentin that were starting a breakthrough. A renaissance was happening, and I wanted to help facilitate that renaissance. And I got lucky. I happened to meet Emily Nanko at a breast cancer walk. And she came in to also do a story on San Quentin News. And when she got to see the level of journalism, she thought that we belong in a bigger pile. And she added on her heart to want to help that process. And I was like, well, I'm glad I met you. And George Floyd was martyred, and it created this storm. And then COVID, COVID hit first, then George Floyd was martyred, then the prison went on lockdown for COVID. And like all these things made it so that the demand for incarcerated voices was up, and people had a lot of time to volunteer and really want to help. They really, it was like a racial reckoning right there, right? Where people could not deny the structural issues in our systems anymore. And so Emily put a call out on social media to our writers group who wants to help partner, pair up with incarcerated writers to do the editing, to do the Submittable for them. And like 100 people said yes. We launched, I think we started a soft launch with like maybe 20 writers to see if it would work. And it worked very well. We hit the New York Times 3 times. I hit Boston Globe personally, NBC Insider, High Country. I mean, I published 42 articles and stories in 31 months. And the guys behind me are excelling. They're going past me. We got people with fellowships, books in the works, like just all kind of, it's beyond my wildest dreams, like art shows, solo exhibits. And now we're co-directing and co-producing films with incarcerated people. It's really beyond my wildest dream.
I mean, your journalistic resume is something that people dream of. I mean, whether you are incarcerated or not. So there are kind of two tracks to your program. There's Writers for Liberation. And as you pointed out, there are about 20 to 25 people in it. And all of these writers are earning money, right? This isn't just something to spend your time on. You really are hoping to create writers who can sustain themselves.
Yeah, and that's so important to me because my father was incarcerated and he was on drugs and he died when I was young. And all that time, my mother took care of me. And so she had to be the mother and the father. That means working overtime, working doubles, but also means she's not there. We're latchkey kids. And that happened because that income is missing and that person is missing. So double the issue. So I figured like if I could have made enough money, if I had this program when I first got incarcerated, how much impact could I have on my kids' life? Right? How can we break those cycles of poverty and intergenerational incarceration? And so I feel like, this program is necessary. And it's also your self-esteem, man. Like if you can't take care of yourself, how low do you feel, And how is that helping anybody do anything, And so, I feel like the economic component is very important.
I wanted to talk about another component of Empowerment Avenue and let people know about it. It's a visual arts program. So similar to the writing, it's artists who are currently housed in prisons, and you're trying to help push their work out as well. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that started because I was watching nonprofits take the art of incarcerated people and give it away or sell it for like $150 to $250 and keep it as a fundraiser for the nonprofit. And I'm like, okay, that's beautiful, right? Guys inside want to help different causes. But like, should we test the value of the artist? You're just giving the paintings away. I just felt like the artists around me were worth so much more than that. And so I wanted to like step in and help them find their value. In fact, I bought a couple of paintings while I was incarcerated. Guys, I think are going to make me a millionaire one day. I'm just waiting. Got the painting in storage, just waiting for my time. It's my retirement plan. It's makes up for that 401k I didn't have. Right? And so I was really, truly, literally invested in the success of these artists. And chance gave me a chance to do something about it. Just chance. Just God is the greatest. The first, a lady named Jo Crowder from Flyaway Productions, she reached out and said she was looking for a black organizer to help her do an art / aerial dancing event dedicated to blacks and Jews teaming up against mass incarceration. And I'm like, what the heck? Yeah, you know, because already I'm a huge Circus of Soleil fan, even though I've never been. And I already had in my heart mind that these artists need a way to get to more. And then this opportunity fell out the sky. And so we started planning this event. And I didn't even know that it meant I would be a curator. I just one day they started asking me questions about writing a curator statement and what I want to name the exhibit and which artist that I want and how did I want this. And I'm like, why do they keep asking me all these questions? They're the museum people. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize what I signed up for. And so it turned out to be this amazing event. And we asked for each artist to be paid just to be in the exhibit, which was new because a lot of times exhibits just mean you get your works up seen. But I felt like we needed more than that. And they agreed. And ever since then, every exhibit we've been in, the artists have been paid just being in the exhibit. And then we use the momentum and the press from the exhibit to try to sell the art. We usually sell, you know, most of it, a lot of it. We never sell all. We're waiting for that day. But we're selling at way better price points than 50 to 100, right? And I'm just trying to see if that, how far we can push the envelope on what the art of incarcerated people can be viewed as being worthy of.
Well, there's an exhibit coming up, and it's entitled Painting Ourselves into Society, which I think is a prompt that you came up with while you were incarcerated. So tell us where we could find that exhibit and what's a piece that we can't miss.
Yeah, you could find that exhibit at the Berkeley Art Center. The opening is September 21st, and the Berkeley Art Center, I believe, is located at 1275 Walnut Street in Berkeley. And a piece you can't miss, Alvin Smith, he painted this lady in a women's prison who's incarcerated, painting an image of herself on the streets voting. And it's amazing.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us on State of the Bay, Rahsaan. It was such a pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you, too. And again, thank you for having me.
To learn more about Rahsaan Thomas and his nonprofit, Empowerment Avenue, check out their website, www.empowermentav.com. That's AVE.org. And don't forget to see the exhibit, which opens on September 21st at Berkeley Art Center, located at 1275 Walnut Street in Berkeley. Again, it's called Painting Ourselves into Society. Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 for our start of KALW's Back to School Month. Yes, that is happening. People are going back to school. We're going to be talking about whether or not cell phones should be banned at Bay Area schools. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen so you never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard tonight, email us. stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb and Katie Colley. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our fabulous board operator. Coming up next is, I think, your call, so stay on and listen. I'm Grace Wan. Good night. Thanks for listening.